Welcome to the Prosperity Through Multifamily Real Estate Investing Podcast. Cody Laughlin and John Beatty speak to industry experts to discuss all aspects of investing in multifamily real estate and seek to help all multifamily real estate investors improve their education and learn proven strategies to grow their businesses. Now here's your hosts, Cody Laughlin and John Beatty.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another installment of the Prosperity Through Multifamily Real Estate Investing Podcast. I'm your host, Cody Laughlin, and joining me for the first time today, my new co-host, Mr. John Beatty.
How's it going?
Welcome to the show, man. I'm excited to have you aboard and looking forward to speaking with our guest today, Mr. Kyle Mitchell, co-founder of APT Capital Group. Kyle, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely, man. Absolutely. Looking forward to this conversation. And so before we get started, a little bit about Kyle. Kyle Mitchell is a real estate entrepreneur who has a focus on multifamily syndication and currently has $17 million of assets under management. He is the managing partner and co-founder of APT Capital Group, whose vision is to provide A-class living to lower income housing by putting the residents first and instilling a sense of community while inspiring others to do the same. Kyle is also the co-host of the weekly real estate podcast, Passive Income Through Multifamily Real Estate, where he speaks with various experts in the real estate industry to help educate and create clarity for passive investors. With a background in operations, management, and logistics, he has overseen multi-million dollar businesses and has a passion in doing the same in the multifamily syndication space. So Kyle, again, man, looking forward to this conversation. Thank you for being on.
Yeah, happy to be here, and I appreciate you having me on.
Absolutely, man. Absolutely. So listen, as we get started, man, tell us a little bit more about yourself and kind of how you got into real estate.
Yeah, I started really investing in real estate in 2010 when I house hacked my primary residence and moved a couple of my friends in there, and they started paying me the rent. And, you know, when you do that and you're not paying a mortgage, that's it's a pretty cool thing. And so
was that in California?
That was in Southern California. Yeah. And so that was my first taste of real estate, but really when I started investing was in 2013. At that time, I had a full-time job, and I was not planning on leaving my full-time job either. I really enjoyed what I did. I was a regional director for a golf management company and one of the larger golf courses in Southern California. And I just needed to put my money to work, and I knew I did not want to use the stock market. I had a bad experience when I was 16 years old. I put a couple grand into a stock. I don't even know what it was now. It was off of a tip from a local golfer, and I lost my money in like a month.
And it's gone.
And I was like, what the heck just happened? So I didn't invest for quite a while after that. I mean, I was only 16 years old, and $2,000 was a lot of money to me at that time. And so I didn't invest for a while, but I knew when I started to invest again, it wasn't going to be in the stock market. So naturally, after I house hacked, I was like, you know what? I want to invest in real estate. It makes sense. I started listening to some podcasts, reading a bunch of books, and I started investing in single family turnkeys at that point, which I found out was a mistake, but I learned a lot from it. And, you know, those houses did okay for me, but I'm currently selling those all off. But I wanted to scale faster, and I wanted to put my money to work faster, and turnkey single family homes one by one just wasn't working. I just thought to myself, man, I'm going to be doing this for 40, 50 years until I'm able to kind of retire and live off of this income. So I did that while I was working at the golf course, and everything was fine. But in 2015, I started saying to myself, I don't know if I want to do this the rest of my life. And I started looking for another career to get into. So I didn't find anything for the first 2 years, and I just kept saving money and preparing myself for it. And then I found multifamily. And as soon as I found multifamily, I absolutely fell in love with it, the business model of it. In the golf course industry, what we were is a property management company, but for golf courses, right? So very similar to property management for apartments. So that was my background. And so I completely understood driving revenues, controlling expenses, hiring, implementing systems, all those things. That's what I've been doing for 15, 16 years. And so 11 months after I found multifamily, even before we took down our first deal, I quit my job and went all in, and nice. Have been doing it ever since. So
that was in 2015?
No, it took me 2 years to find multifamily, and okay. Then I educated myself for about 11 months and then left. So it's been about a year and a half since I left. So 2018.
Wow. So you got to have a pretty powerful mindset to be able to just quit your W-2, you know, everything that you depend on, and jump just full force into this.
And an amazing wife. He supports me. That's the biggest thing.
So talk to us, man. Like, so how did you get to build up enough of courage to make that leap? I mean, again, you're talking about just leaving everything you depend on to go at this full force. I mean, you know, how did you build up that courage?
Yeah, it was scary all the way up until the point that I did it, and, you know, several months after that. But the one thing was, is it didn't happen overnight. You know, we had been educating ourselves on multifamily for 11, 12 months. And even before that, I had been planning on finding something that I wanted to shift into, right?
So, did you look at real estate predominantly?
You know what? I didn't even look at real estate until one day my friend said, why don't you look into real estate? I mean, I had my real estate license. I had, you know, I had been investing in real estate, but it just never, it was a mindset thing in my head that to be a full-time real estate investor, it really didn't exist, right? It wasn't something that you did on the side. And then when I found multifamily, that was another mindset shift. Can you really buy apartment buildings that are $15, $20 million? I mean, when you first hear that, it just seems too good to be true. And you think only the rich do that. And that's absolutely not true. So I had to get over that mindset. And you do that by educating yourself, right? So the first thing that we did was we started a meetup. We were going to meetups. And when I say we, it was my wife and I after work. And so this was our side gig that we were working 30, 40 hours a week on after we got off work. And that's how we started to build up the confidence, because we started meeting people in the industry, getting to know them, expanding our network. And then slowly we started another meetup, started a podcast. And once you start doing all those things, you start to build up the confidence.
That's awesome. So fast forward, you know, you spent all that time getting educated, you built your confidence. Again, you went through those mindset shifts, if you will. Walk us through your first deal and when did you come across that and kind of how that came to pass?
Yeah, so I left my job in November, and in January, we had a deal under contract. So it was just two short months, and we actually saw that property in December and then got it under contract in January. So I knew it was going to be pretty soon because we were actively making offers. Our investor list had been built over a year, so we felt comfortable also raising money. But the way that happened was my wife and I used to wake up at 2 a.m. while we had our full-time jobs and drive to Tucson and Phoenix. We would leave at 2 a.m, get there at like 9 a.m. And a couple of days before that, I would call brokers and our property management company and say, hey, we're going to visit. Can you tour with us? And is there anything we can see? And that's when we got the deal. We were driving in one morning and the broker called me and said, hey, Kyle, I just got the keys to this property. Do you want to come see it? You'll be the first one to see it. And I said, absolutely. So timing is everything. And, you know, we got lucky there. But if we weren't driving there that morning, we would have never seen it, or we wouldn't have been the first to see it. So luckily, our property management company met us there. And afterwards, we liked it. So we started touring comps with the property management company as well. And so we did a lot of due diligence or upfront work that day before anyone had even seen the property. So a couple of weeks later, it did go to market, but we were one of the first offers in. And I have a good relationship with that broker. And, you know, kind of the rest is history. We were able to take that one down.
Man, that's that.
Units was that?
That was a smaller one, 42 units, but I think perfect for our first deal. Learned a ton on that deal, and I'm grateful that it was that size and not any larger. A lot of people say you can go into larger stuff first, but if you're doing it, you know, we were a lead sponsor on our first deal, and I think if you're going to be a lead sponsor on your first deal, I would suggest going a little bit smaller and not going in to the larger stuff unless you have a partner that is really taking the lead and you're taking the backseat to learn.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a property management on that size? On site or?
So yes, we have a third party property management company. And it's the same one we use on our larger stuff too. We kind of got lucky in that sense. They typically don't manage under 100 units, but they were, you know, we had built a relationship up with them. They said, okay, we'll take this one on. But we don't have full-time on-site management and we don't have an office there. So we do have part-time staff. So we've got 15 to 20 hours depending for the maintenance person doing any work orders and things like that. And then the leasing person works between 16 and 20 hours as well, depending on where we are as far as occupancy is concerned.
Right. So that relationship really cemented your ability to take down that 42 unit, which would typically folks are probably not doing that under, you know, 70, 100 units, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, the property management company that was managing it before, there are property management companies that do that size, but it, you know, you never have an on-site. But the property management company that was doing it before was a single family home property management company, which we saw as a huge opportunity because for single family homes, maintenance are usually service calls, right? So they're hiring that person out, whether it be a plumber or a locksmith or someone else. They don't have someone on staff fixing those things. So they're paying $30, $40 an hour plus travel time and all that just to fix these things. So that's one of the first things I saw as far as an opportunity is we can knock down the payroll and the repair and maintenance lines immediately.
That's excellent, man. I want to go back and just add, you know, and I hope the listeners caught on to what you were saying, where, you know, like you said, you and your wife were getting up at 2 o'clock in the morning, driving to these markets and putting in that work. And it's important for people to understand that you have to be willing to put yourself out there and do the things that others aren't willing to do to gain that success, right? And so so kudos to you, man. That's awesome. I love hearing those stories because I hope that inspires other people to know that, you know, you do have to put in the work to gain that momentum. So but I want to go back to, you know, getting into your first deal. What were some of the challenges that you faced in putting that deal together?
Yeah, we faced every challenge that I can think of going through it. And the first thing I would say is we felt comfortable with the amount that we would need to raise. And it was a smaller deal. We were actually going to use the net worth and liquidity of our parents. They were going to sign on the loan and we were going to take the deal down by ourselves. And looking back now, it's obvious to me that that was not the right way to go. We should have partnered with some other people, which we ended up doing, and I can get into that in a bit. But trying to take it all down by yourself is probably a mistake on your first deal, right? Even though we have the background of operations and management, I'm fully confident in my ability to manage a property. But the stuff I didn't know and hadn't been through was all the stuff pre-close, right? Switching everything over, the lender was one of the biggest challenges, but dealing with all the stuff pre-close was a challenge for sure. So eventually we got to the point where we didn't feel fully confident that we were going to be able to raise the full funds. So we had to raise about $1 million on this one. We ended up raising $900,000 and then we brought in some partners that brought in some money to clean that up. But if you can't raise the full million, you can't execute your full business plan, right? So we didn't want to get caught in that situation where, okay, yeah, we can close with $700,000, but we can't implement our business plan. So that puts our investors' capital at risk, and that's just not what we're going to do. So when we were at about $500,000, I thought we can get there, but I wasn't quite sure. So I said, we need to bring on some other partners. Right. And that was a challenge in itself because we were going with a Freddie Mac loan. Our broker had already submitted the loan docs and Freddie said, no, we're not adding any more GPs. It's too late in the game. You got to go with the team that you're with now.
How far into that process were you?
So I communicated this to the broker that this was our business plan, right? That if we didn't get to a certain point, we were going to add GPs and we were told, okay, and come to find out they submitted it too early. I think we were 3 or 4 weeks into the process. So at that point, I had to decide to pull the plug and go with another lender or just go it alone and hopefully raise the funds. And, you know, we ended up literally on the last day, it was like 7 o'clock. My partner calls a lender he had never met through a referral in New York. So it's 10 p.m. in New York. The guy's walking off a cruise ship and says, send me the paperwork. I'll take a look. I'll let you know by Monday if I can do it. On Monday, he says, we'll do this. We have 29 days to close. So it's not a lot of time. And he says, we'll get this done. And I jumped ship and it ended up working out, but it could have really been a disaster.
down to the wire.
Yeah. I mean, 29 days is just, it's too close. And the good thing is the third party reports are transferable. So a lot of that stuff had already been done. And we ended up getting an 81 basis point discount on the interest rates because we were locked at 5.01% with Freddie. When we switched over to Fannie, it starts all over. Basically, you can't really lock until about a week before. And that's when the interest rates just tanked. Yeah. And so we ended up getting a good deal. We're at 4.2%.
Oh, wow. Which is huge.
Yeah, which is not great right now because the interest rates are even lower. But it ended up working out. But the biggest challenge was understanding how to communicate with the lender, some of the things that they do, and how they can control the deal. You know, it's just all those things you don't know until you know and go through it once.
Yeah. So take us through that a little bit. So what are some key things that we need to know in communicating with the lenders to make this go as smoothly as possible?
Yeah, get everything in writing because, you know, when I was telling our broker, it was over the phone and, you know, later on I had no back documentation on the whole thing. The other thing I would say is just ask as many questions as possible. The other thing I didn't understand is that if we utilized our extension, which we did utilize our extension, if you're rate locked with Freddie and it goes past 30 days, you know, they're basically hedging their bets on you closing that loan, right? So they add a 5 basis point penalty on your interest rate if you don't close within that 30 days. So the more you can communicate upfront on what your business plan is with the lender, then the better, right? I think a lot of times people sit back and say, oh, I don't want the lender to know that because then they could, you know, maybe the collections will come be lower, so my proceeds will be less and things like that. And I just think it's better to just be upfront and transparent and just say, hey, look, this is our business plan. This is exactly what we want to happen. If this doesn't happen, this is kind of plan B, and just let them just put it out on the table to them so they understand what it is so they can work with you. I mean, they're your partner in this, right? They're loaning you 65 to 80% of the money. So they should be fully aware of what's going on. And I think if you work with them and look at them as a partner, then they're going to be more likely willing to work with you on certain things than if you're keeping things from them and looking at them like they're more of a pain in your side. So,
yeah. So that's really interesting. This scenario, you know, scenario A, scenario B, that scenario assessment, give us a little bit more example on that with the lender.
I think the example I gave with our 42 unit was basically we had our team in place. This is who we wanted to close. And if we can raise all the money, no problem. That's scenario A.
Right.
But in 3 weeks, if we're only at this much capital raised, this is going to be scenario B. We're going to bring on these two partners, and this is what the structure is going to look like there. You know, and that way they would be fully prepared for both scenarios, and they can tell you at that point, yes or no, or if with scenario
B. Was that the one in writing or not?
That was the one that was not in writing.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
Yeah. And I think ultimately, even if it was in writing, the lender has the control, right? They're loaning the most amount of money. So they could pull out on the last day, an hour before closing, if they wanted to. And there's nothing really you can do about it. So the other thing on that is always have a backup plan. You know, you have scenario A and B, but always have a backup plan. Because if that lender can't close, you're going to need someone else there behind that to do it quickly, whether it's a hard money loan, bridge loan for a short amount of time, or whatever it is. You need to have those ducks in a row.
Yeah, so always have your lender that was stepping off the cruise ship on speed dial, I guess.
Yeah, the crazy thing is we had never met him. You know, it was a referral, so that is great. But if he didn't answer there, I don't know what I would have done, because it was either dumping the deal or just forging forward, hoping that we could raise the rest of the funds. So I'm grateful for the way that opportunity turned out, because it ended up being a great deal, you know, for everybody.
Absolutely. Out of curiosity, you said you're running meetups before this whole thing, right? And so that's how you're developing your investor database.
Yeah, so we started right when we started the company. We started doing monthly emails, even though we had very few people on there. And so it's all about consistency, right? So for the last 2.5 years, on the first of the month at 10 a.m., our database gets a newsletter, and then we started the meetup, and that's every Tuesday at 6:30 or every second Tuesday at the same location every month consistently. But yeah, that's mainly where our database came from, is just networking with people at our meetups and going to other people's meetups and just telling people what we were doing.
Just out of curiosity, I'm sure this varies widely. How many people were on your email list or your network list for your first deal?
So there's two different things. There's an email list, which is just general education and knowledge. And then there's actually an investor list. So there was about 100 people on that list.
Okay.
We ended up having about 23 investors. So about 23% invested. I don't know if that's good or bad, but
it sounds like a pretty warm list. I mean, of investors. So it's good.
Yeah, I would definitely say, though, if you think you can raise $1 million the first time around, I would cut that in half at least to a $500,000.
That's a good rule of thumb for anybody starting out.
Yeah,
because you think you can, divide by two.
Life happens, right? And so just because they want to invest does not mean that specific deal at that specific time is going to be right for them.
Well, very similar to what you were mentioning, where you just so happen to catch a lender by referral at the right time. I mean, it's all about timing. A lot of this is about timing in the industry, right? So, and in speaking to your investor database, I mean, not having a track record, you know, your first deal, how did you nurture those relationships to get those 20-something investors to partner with you?
I think people saw that my wife and I were serious, right? No one that is not serious is going to wake up at 2 a.m. and drive to Tucson and not get home for 24 hours and then go to their full-time job the next day, right? So it was telling people what we were doing and just being transparent and communicating. But when people see that you're that serious, you know, it catches people's eyes. Most of those first investors were friends and family for sure. But other people just believed in us, you know, and it's all about positioning yourself and telling people why they should believe in you. And, you know, our operations and management background is extensive. My wife is also a general manager of a golf course. And so she has extensive management operations background too. And that's really what apartment investing is. It's not buying apartments, you know, it's buying a business and managing and operating that business. And we have a lot of experience in that. So I think a lot of people saw that in us as well, but it wasn't easy raising money the first time. And it's definitely, there's two different businesses, managing an apartment and raising capital. They're really two separate companies and two separate things. Yeah, it was just showing people that we were serious.
Sure. And I think, again, to highlight what you were saying is you had started a meetup prior to having this deal. You started building that database before and you started nurturing those relationships, right? And so the old verbiage or adage that, you know, if you have a good deal, the money will come is it's really just not a true statement in this space. And so you really have to, when you're talking about raising, you know, $500,000, $1 million+, whatever it is, you know, you have to have people that trust in you, like you said, to believe in you. And that way they know that their money's going to be safe in your hands. And so I think it's important for people to understand that you should always be raising money, right? You should always be developing those relationships and that trust amongst the people that you're networking with, right?
Yeah, 100%, no doubt about it. I mean, from the time we started building our database to the time we closed was 18 months, right? So 18 months of building relationships and building that database up. If we would have had a deal even 6 months earlier, we would not have been ready. We were making offers and I was hoping to get a deal, but I'm grateful that we didn't because we just would not have been ready to do it, education-wise and investor-wise.
Yeah, that's such a great point because people need to understand that this is definitely a slow, steady race. It's definitely not one that's going to happen overnight. And you have to be willing to put in that time investment as well as the hard work to build that over time. So that's great. So I want to kind of get to the point of acquisition. So you got through the challenges, you got, you know, you raised the money, you got the lender, you got to close. Let's get to the aspect of the asset management. So, you know, this is your first deal. You've had some background in golf course property management. What were some of the things that you were able to take from your previous experience and implement on your first deal as far as the asset management side?
Yeah, managing people, which, you know, it's all about managing the manager and implementing systems. I mean, that is what you need to do as an asset manager. And you consistently improve on those systems week by week, month by month to create more efficiencies in the business, right? But the other thing that I did is I'm a big Tony Robbins guy, and he always says, model after others, or like everyone says, don't recreate the wheel. And so, you know, our partners had invested in several deals passively through several different sponsors. And what we did is we modeled after the best of the best. And we took what they do that we liked and then implemented our own stuff on the side too. And from day one, I think we've done a really nice job of the communication piece to the investors, which I think is crucial. Open communication, transparency, and as much communication as you can. And then as far as managing the managers, you know, I mean, that's just what I did for the last 16 years. So it just came very natural to me to set up systems and the weekly calls and make sure we're holding them accountable.
So let's expand on that a little bit. So what were some of the systems that kind of helped you get this thing started in the right direction?
Yeah, it's all about documentation. Whether you use Google Sheets or Excel or whatever you want to start, we use our CRM database for this, for the calls, but it's communication and follow-up. I think the biggest key is follow-up, right? I think a lot of times people have a call, they'll say, hey, Kyle, make sure you do this, this, and this. And I say, okay, and I don't do any of them, right? We never talk about it again. And then 6 months later, when there's an issue on that item, we say, hey, Kyle, why haven't you been doing that? Oh, I totally forgot. And now you're in the same spot you were 6 months ago, except more frustrated and probably in a worse spot. So it's all about keeping documentation so you can always refer back to it. And so not only are you talking about current items on your weekly calls, but you're also reviewing the things that you said were going to get done the previous week. And if that's not done, that carries over to the next list, right? And so it's all in the details and the follow-up.
So you're documenting this in your CRM. whatever you're using as basically a task list from your weekly calls and to keep people accountable.
Exactly. And, you know, as they get done and moved off the list, they just get crossed off, or they'll get moved over to the following week, right? You have high priority items and you have low priority items, obviously, and you want to knock out the high priority items first. So sometimes things move up and down the list, but you just keep that list and you make sure that the property management company has a copy of that list as well and understands how you worked off of it. And the other big thing is to make sure your property management company is one that is going to be flexible with the way you do business. You own that apartment building. They don't own it. They manage it for you and you've hired them. And so they should be able to be flexible enough to adjust their systems and processes to fit what you want so you can run the business like you want.
Can you expand on that? What kind of flexibility would be an example?
Mainly the reports and the KPIs we want to see, okay. Right? So if the reports are being sent to me in a certain way, like a lot of times they were sending them in a PDF document. I want them in Excel so I can play around with them, sort things a certain way. We've added a couple other new reports so I can see the time that the days, the units are vacant in each phase. Not just, okay, it's been vacant for 42 days. It's been vacant for 15 days during the rehab or the turn. It's been vacant for 14 days in the lease up and all those different things, right? And it's been 12 days for the eviction. So I can see where there's bottlenecks being created versus just seeing 42 days. I don't know what that means until you dig in a little bit deeper. And so they've been gracious enough to adjust their reporting to be able to show that. So it's just things like that. You won't know until you ask, but they should be able to be flexible. Because like I said, going back to it, you own the building, not them.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a license for whatever system they're using? Let's just say it's Yardi or AppFolio. Mm-hmm. You can kind of get in there and actually see what's going on day to day.
Yep, I can. Yeah. So our property management company uses Yardi. And so if I wanted to go in there right now and see if they've leased anything up, which I'm in there twice a day right now, three times a day with everything going on with, you know, the coronavirus stuff. I'm seeing if they leased up. And the amazing thing is,
and they know that.
They do know it, yeah. But they leased up a property, a unit today, which is fantastic. You know, you wouldn't think right now that units are getting leased up, but they are.
One has been looking harder than right now.
Yep, exactly.
So take us back, though. You know, what are some things or some key things that we want to look at in identifying a property management team that we want to work with? So how did you find the property management company that you worked with on your first deal?
Yeah, this is so important, and I cannot stress enough, property management company is going to make or break your deal, period. I mean, you can be the best asset manager in the world, but if you don't have a good property management company, they're not going to follow through on the things that you need. And so it's just super key. But what we did is we asked for referrals from other investors in that local area or brokers, and we built up a list of probably 10 property management companies. And I would say half of those eliminated themselves pretty quickly. But we have a questionnaire for every property management company, and this may seem excessive, but it's 65 questions. And I asked all of them to fill that out and send it back to me. And you don't really get a lot of responses when you have zero units, you've never been in the market, they don't know who you are, but you get to see how they communicate, right? And we also, when we drove out there, we toured properties with each individual property management company so we can get a sense of who they are and how they work and how detailed they are and how they act and all those types of things. And by process of elimination, you know, it really came out to one that was shining.
Yeah.
And I really loved how they respond quickly because I'm the type of person that if I send an email, I want it back as soon as possible. And they respond very quickly. So very responsive, very transparent, flexible, and willing to, you know, work with a new investor and tour properties and be open to that. And so that's how we did it. You know, we went from 10 down to one.
Were they also in a growth phase or were they a large kind of established property manager?
So they operate in both Phoenix and Tucson, which are both of our markets, and they're very large in Phoenix, but they had just seen a large sell-off from all their owners in Tucson. And so they were well under the number that they wanted to be at. So they were in growth phase. I think they're always in growth phase, but they wanted more properties in Tucson, which allowed us to be able to get a 42 unit in their portfolio, which is, you know, not usual.
Mm-hmm. How many people actually filled out the 65 question?
It was probably out of the 10, I would say there was three or four. I was
okay, so that dropped off a lot.
Yeah, so half of them, more than half of them were gone immediately. And I don't know if, you know, looking back now, being as a little bit more experience. That's a lot of questions for a property management company to ask. And if you have, I'm sure they have 10, 15, 20 new investors calling them on a monthly basis. If they had to do that every time. So I think I'd be a little bit more flexible with that now. But the fact that I got three or four of those back meant, hey, they wanted our business, you know? But if we had not been doing a podcast and meetups and had a website, you know, immediately, I mean, we had a website before we started the meetup. We were just very serious about that stuff. So people need to find you. If you're talking to an investor or a property management company or a broker, trust me, when you're telling you're a new investor or you're coming to that market, they're going to Google you, right? No. It's so easy to find that. And so when they went to our website, and we have a professional looking website and it shows we have a meetup and all these different things and a newsletter. Okay, now we're a little bit more credible. So maybe they will take the time to fill out that questionnaire versus, you know, can't find this guy, don't know who he is, doesn't know how to talk about real estate at all. So there are other things that we did in advance to allow for, you know, people to fill that questionnaire out.
Absolutely. I think just a little side note, you know, speaking to that, you know, there are certain things like a website where you don't want to really cut corners on, right? You want it to look, for example, that's the face of your company, right? So you want to make sure that you do look professional, that you have that good presence in there because you want to make that good first impression. So I appreciate you mentioning that. But going back to the property management team, would you agree that, you know, just as important as the lender is and as big as a partner as a lender is, so is your property manager, right? If like you said, a good property manager will make or break your deal. So you really want to have that cohesive relationship with that property manager and you really want to have that great communication with them. And so you want to treat them equally as a partner in the deal, right?
100%. I mean, you've got, it goes back to like when I was managing people at the golf course, right? They're not machines. Yeah, these are human beings, right? And if you treat them like machines, they're going to break down eventually and they're going to be sick and tired of working for you. You know, this is a human business. This is a relationship business and you need to treat people with respect. Now, doesn't mean you don't hold them accountable, but you need to treat them with respect and, you know, thank them for the things that they do for you. Send them gifts, send them bonuses. I mean, these are people working jobs for you and, you know, property management is not a very high margin business either. It's very low margin. So, and when owners are trying to push rents and control costs, I mean, it's very difficult to be a property management company, to be honest with you, and work for a property management company. So yeah, they're human beings and it's a complete relationship business and they are a partner of yours.
Absolutely. It's important for, you know, you're a business owner, right? And so you want to run your business and you want to create a culture that embraces, you know, those relationships and that growth, because ideally I'm sure you'd want them to grow with you, right? And help you scale. So I'm so glad you said that. You definitely want to treat everybody as if, you know, how you would want yourself to be treated. So I appreciate that as well. So what were some of the biggest takeaways that you had from that first deal that you applied moving forward on your next few deals?
Yeah, I think, you know, when you first get into multifamily, when you're taking down your first deal, there's obviously some questions in the back of your head. Can we do this? Is this, you know, the right deal and all those types of things. So you build confidence for sure. And you understand that, okay, I get this a little bit better now. It's that confidence that takes you into that next deal. But again, my background was operations and management. So I felt very comfortable with it once we closed on the property. But the biggest takeaway was building a team in advance and knowing who that team's going to be so that you can take down these deals. And you know, there's so many pieces of the pie that you can share with multifamily and it really is a team sport. And so don't be greedy and, you know, build the team in advance. And that team that did this small 42 unit, 3 weeks later, we got under contract 128 unit property, right? And now we're doing that deal together and now we're looking for more deals. And so because we partnered on that first deal, it led into the second deal. If we didn't partner on that first deal, we would not have gotten 128 unit because it came from one of those partners. And so, you know, it's just building a team.
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, there are very few people that I've met and talked to that have been successful doing this on their own. I won't say that you can't. It's been done, but it, like you said, if you really want to scale and really
not a good model to follow.
Yeah. If you really want to scale, you really have to have that great partnership and team around you. So, I definitely would encourage the listeners, if you haven't already, you know, start, like you said, start building that team, start looking for partners right now, you know, and that way you can just continue to grow and scale. So I want to fast forward kind of where we're at today. So, and taking your experience, not only from the acquisitions and property management on the assets that you have now, but we're faced with some troubling times now. You know, obviously we're in the thick of the coronavirus outbreak, and there's a lot of uneasiness in the market today. What are some things that you're doing from a property management perspective or an asset management perspective in light of what we're going through?
Yeah, number one, it's communication and transparency with our investors. That's the first thing that we do, is communicate to them and let them know, okay, we've got a plan in place. This is what we're doing. Here's what we're seeing and hearing. And if something changes a couple days later, we'll send another email out, right? I mean, typically our communication is once a month and then we do a quarterly webinar. But right now, that's out the window. I mean, if it's every day, it's every day. If it's every week, it's every week. But we want to make sure the investors know that we're on top of it and that their money is safe, right? And so, you know, I've talked to a lot of people through this whole crisis, and the sponsors are going to be remembered on how they handled this situation. Did you panic? Did you, you know, were you on top of things? Do you know what you're doing? Did you communicate, or did you shy away from communicating with your investors? This is not the time to shy away and not communicate to your investors, even if things are going to be bad, because we know things are going to be bad when the rental collections, you know, next month, but just be transparent and honest. You know, that's what they want to hear. They want to understand. And so if you're hiding behind a rock right now, it's not the right way to do it.
Yeah. And you know, I've said this a couple of times, and to several different people I've talked to, I think you're right. I think you're going to see which operators, syndicators are, you know, I don't want to say, you know, savvy or, you know, prudent to what's going on and how they handle that, you know, through this time. And by no means do we want anybody to fail or not succeed, but this is going to show, you know, the past investors out there looking to partner with good operators, which ones really have, you know, the wherewithal, I guess, if you will, to handle this type of storm. So what are some things that you're doing in anticipation for, you know, your drop in, you know, you getting your rent collections or your economic vacancy? So what are some things that you're implementing on your assets to help manage that, if you will?
Yeah, I think it's important to have a toolbox of different things to go to and be flexible for the residents, right? The first thing is we're waiving all late fees and extra charges going forward. We're trying to talk to each individual resident individually to see what their situation is and how we can best help them. But it's about being proactive and helping the residents. You know, yes, the investor's money is important. Yes, the bottom line is important. But right now, you know, people are in time of crisis and you need to help them get through it. So another thing that we're doing is there are jobs out there. There are companies hiring, Amazon, Whole Foods, Walmart, Target. They're all very busy right now because people are panicking. And so the other thing we're doing is every day we're sending out any job postings to anyone that, to the whole community really. But so anyone that lost their job, we're being able to offer them, you know, hey, check it out. Down the street, they're hiring. Why don't you go check that out? We're also doing lease modifications and just working with things like partial payments for the first month. We're doing a raffle. Anyone who pays their rent by the first of the month, they'll get entered into a raffle and they can win, you know, X percentage off their rent for the next month. And we're giving that away to a handful of people, you know, to try and encourage people to pay rent on time. If they are having some hardships, we want to give them links and access to any rental assistance programs that are out there that can help at this time. But really, everything's on the table right now. We want to help the residents as much as possible and get through this together and not be that landlord that only thinks of themselves. Now, we do need to collect the rents, and we've been very clear with the residents that, look, in order to keep the lights on at this property, we need you to pay rents and help. But we're going to be there next to you, helping you along the way as well.
Yeah.
Definitely a people-first approach to what you have. And so I commend you for doing that. And what you've just said are some great examples that I haven't heard before, like the raffle.
Yeah.
And sent the right behaviors, helping people out with jobs, sending them links, and just actually helping people get the resources, because not everyone knows where all the resources are. So you're kind of funneling that to your property.
Yeah. And imagine those residents, if they do get a job and they can pay their rent and, you know, that we were able to help them, are they likely to stay and pay rent going forward? Heck yes. You know,
they're probably likely to take care of your property.
Yeah. The residents are as much of a partner of yours as anyone else as well. You know, when you look at it, I mean, they don't have a say in a lot of the things, obviously, but you look at them as a partner and a person that you're building a relationship with. And when you look at it like that, I think it helps with retention and community building and culture.
Yeah. And I like your comments on focusing on like the individuals, like you're going kind of unit by unit here. Yeah. You're not just saying, oh, okay, there's 42 units or whatever. I've need to do X, Y, and Z. You're really digging into the granularity, literally, of the property.
Yeah, that's another thing. I haven't heard of people interviewing individual tenants throughout. That's fantastic.
Yeah, because you need to know, you know, what jobs are they coming from, right? If they're in retail or hospitality or a service industry, they're going to be hurting more than someone that's, you know, maybe a student at school that are having their parents pay their rent or whatever it may be, right? And so certain people are going to need more help than others. And by doing that, yeah, it takes more time, obviously, but at the same time, it's more of a one-on-one experience and you understand that people care about your situation and we're able to customize things per your situation. You don't want to blanket it. You know, every person's situation is different and maybe they don't need, you know, as much as you think, or maybe they need more. But we want to understand that so we can react appropriately.
Yeah, I love that.
I love it.
Yeah, absolutely. That's awesome. What has been some of the tenant feedback that you've received from implementing some of those strategies?
Yeah, right now, I think everyone is just grateful that we're trying to help. It's still very early, right? We have not gone through the first month of collections yet. We're sitting here in March, and the first month of collections will be in April. And so we'll really see how things happen then. But it's been good, you know? I mean, obviously, when you try and help people, they're going to react a little bit differently than if you're just pounding on their door for rent. So far the reaction's been good, but it's only been a couple of weeks. And in Arizona, they're a little bit lagging where we're at here in California with this whole thing. So it's actually been only about a week and they have a limited number of cases right now. So, you know, depending on where you're at, I mean, if you're near New York, it's probably a much different scenario than it is where it is in Arizona. So
I'd love to follow up in a month or two.
Yeah, absolutely. In May, I think, is where we're going to see the biggest hit on delinquencies, because I think some people are going to be able to still pay in April, but we'll see how it shakes out. There's so many things that can change. Things are changing hourly right now. Right. And so it's really tough to gauge. We're just prepared to take a bit of a hit. And thankfully, on both properties that we have enough cash reserves to get us through quite a few years right now of mortgage payments.
That feels good.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's important. I think it's important to highlight that too. I think one of the bigger challenges is, will people have enough working capital to weather that, drop in vacancies or economic vacancies? And so, I think that's huge. So,
yeah, business plans are going to be adjusted for sure. Yeah. You're going to have to adjust your business plan, even if we only go through this for the next 2 or 3 months. But, yeah, capital reserves and cash in the bank is king right now. And so we've stopped all of our renovations. We're finishing the ones that are in progress, but we've completely stopped renovations, cut expenses everywhere that we can.
Have you suspended distributions?
You know what? Right now, I've not made that decision. And I think a lot of people will give me a lot of pushback on this right now. But I haven't made a decision because I don't need to pay out right now. We pay out quarterly, and that decision is not to be made until we have to pay out, right? Because things are changing daily. And so to say that we're going to hold back distributions is highly likely, but I'm set up in one of our properties, the 42 unit, we have 3 years of mortgage payments saved up.
Wow.
And so to say I'm not going to make a distribution there, I don't know. We might, right? Because we had a great first quarter and we have 3 years of reserves. So I'm not sure yet. We're leaning towards holding back because cash is definitely king right now. And you don't want to make a stupid mistake, but right now, I don't have to make that decision. In a few weeks, I will, and then we'll see where we go from there.
No, that's great. How are your investors? What's on their mind right now? I think I can imagine, but I'd love to hear it from you.
Yeah, to be honest, I think right now their investments are not on their mind. I mean, if their money's in the stock market, I'm sure it's a little bit different, but I think it's with their families and making sure that they're healthy and safe. But like I said, we over-communicate and we allow our investors to decide how much of our content they want to consume, right? If I'm doing it every day and you don't want to see me, you can just delete the email. But if you're someone that wants to be updated day by day, then that's what you're getting. So I just think that they want to be communicated with, you know, they want to understand that the person they put their money with is competent and transparent.
Great.
That's awesome. Well, Kyle, I think we're getting near the end of our time here, man. And I would love to spend more time, discussing this further. And I like John's idea. Maybe we can circle back in a couple months after, you know, the dust has settled a little bit and see what's changed.
I hope my hair is still the same color and I don't have huge bags under my eyes. I mean, but I'd be happy to come back on and share. You know, this is all about, I love what you guys are doing and adding value. And I'm happy to share our challenges and our successes.
Well, I got a few more questions for you to wrap up here, and kind of unrelated to what we've been talking about, but who has been the biggest inspiration to you and your success?
Yeah, so I would say within the industry, it's, I'll just name a couple of names like Rod Khalif and Michael Blanc. Those guys gave me the opportunity to communicate with them. A lot of these guys are very busy and they were open enough to communicate and come speak at our meetups and things like that. Outside of it, one of my role models, like I said earlier, is Tony Robbins. And I also love Tim Ferriss. I'm addicted to his podcast. And he's a guy that I really look up to and really love how he handles certain situations.
Mm-hmm. What have been some of the most valuable lessons learned throughout your syndication career that you could give advice to others?
Yeah, number one, it's about consistency. If you're consistent, you're going to separate yourself from 95% of the people out there. And it sounds so simple, and it is so simple, but it's easier said than done, right? But be consistent with everything you can do, be intentional, and you'll be in the top 5% guaranteed.
And so what are some things that you're doing to continue your education and learning to further and advance your investing career?
Yeah, I'm a podcast junkie. So I listen to, I have 18 different podcasts I listen to. Some are daily, some are, a couple times a week, some are 5 minutes, some are 2 hours. So that's the one thing I do. I'm reading books. I go to seminars, podcasts. We learn a lot by our podcast, hosting other people, kind of like what you guys do as well. We do meetups as well. And I learn a lot from other people there, but it's just being out and getting to know people and trying to expand your network.
Awesome. And how can the listeners connect with you and learn more about you?
Yeah, I appreciate that. I always give out my cell phone. I'm happy to talk to anybody, 562-833-5010. We are going through a transition in companies right now and merging with our business partner. And so our website is under construction, but depending on when you listen to this, hopefully it'll be up. It's aptcapitalgroup.com. And we've got a free passive investors guide on there that you can sign up for. And that basically takes you through the process of syndication and the things you should learn and know about before getting involved in the syndication.
That's great. We'll make sure to put that in the show notes as well, so that way everybody will be able to see it just in the case they miss it. So, well, Kyle, man, thank you again for your time. This has been a great conversation and looking forward to catching up with you again in a couple months. And just congratulations on your success, man.
Yeah, thanks, guys. I appreciate you having me on.
Want to connect with Cody and John? Email them at cody@blueoakinvests.com. or john@blueoakinvests.com. Thank you for listening to the Prosperity Through Multifamily Real Estate Investing podcast. Tune in next time.